of our community. Again, just visit kpft.org to donate. Thanks. This is 90.1 KPFT Houston.
Unruffled Beat of Clouds Below Your Knees by Ray Lynch signals Thursday, 10 p.m., and time for What's Your Story, the only program originating in Houston devoted entirely to storytelling, right here on listener-sponsored 90.1 KPFT Houston. I'm your host, Greg Audell. I'm editor of Grout 101 and on the board of Writers in the Schools. The goal of both organizations is to help young people create and tell their own story. And I'd like to thank So What's Your Story's creator and host, Dr. Hank Robichek, for inviting me to become a host of this wonderful program, helping me bring you stories of strong and hardworking young people who often become accomplished adults is our favorite veteran, Jacob Reiner, who's working the magic in the control room. Say hi, Jake.
How y'all doing out there tonight?
My mother was a reporter and editor of our hometown newspapers in Pearland and Friendswood, Texas. So I learned at an early age that the story behind the official version of news is almost always more interesting than the story we're told. My guest tonight personifies this fact. Former supermodel Elena Davis graced the covers of the world's top fashion magazines and lived a glamorous lifestyle most people only dream about. She's since parlayed her success into becoming one of Houston's fiercest advocates for the homeless, and her motivation for doing so comes from a very personal place. If you were to judge Elena by a snapshot image taken at any single point in her life, you'd be missing a fascinating story. Elena's compelling story began long ago, long before the world took notice of her. She was raised in Berkeley, in Washington, D.C., San Francisco, Oakland, Palm Springs, Hollywood, and Los Angeles. Sounds like a life you'd expect from a future fashion model and the daughter-in-law of one of the most powerful titans in Hollywood. Elena, you've lived a ways in that most people and most of our listeners have only read about throughout much of your life, and you have a fascinating story. Welcome to the studio.
Thank you.
You are the founder and president of I Am Water, which has created a unique way to help the homeless. Can you tell us a little bit more about I Am Waters?
Yeah, we are a nonprofit based in Houston, Texas, and we are the only organization in the United States providing water. I mean, the concept of it is physical and spiritual hydration. So we provide bottles of water, and on the bottles are words such as love, hope, peace, and dream.
I love that.
And we deliver them free of charge through homeless shelters.
Wow. I know you were a successful model for many years, who's lived in Paris, Beverly Hills, and more than a dozen other places. Was being a globe-trotting fashion model as glamorous as you imagined it would be?
I don't think I didn't have anything to base an imagination off of what it would be like. The only thing I imagined was is that I was going to do this job and make money and then go to the grocery store and buy food. I didn't really have any other preconceived notions about anything other than food.
Right, right.
Eating. I was like really concerned about the basics. Yeah.
Well, you know, that leads us into our topic tonight. I think many people would be amazed that a model who married into Hollywood royalty would be attuned to the needs of the homeless population. And remember, friends, the homeless is not some vague mass. It's a population like any other, made up of very real individuals, the vast majority of whom are single moms and kids. Do you know the breakdown of the homeless population in Harris County, Texas?
I mean, if you break down...
As far as women and children versus what people might tend to think of as a typical homeless person?
Well, I think, there's like 5,300 homeless people in Harris County. And, you know, I think it's something, you know, like there's like 3,000 people odd, you know, that are sheltered. And then I think there's like another 2,000 or so that are not sheltered. But more importantly, you know, this comes from the HUD PIT count, the point in time count, which is done across the nation. Unfortunately, that count actually doesn't include people that are living in their cars, that are couch surfing. So as far as
the huge number.
Yeah. I mean, the growing numbers of homelessness are, you know, we have veterans, but female veterans is a growing demographic, and then families a lot, you know, definitely right. Families. And it's really, you know, I say that homelessness is a crisis of poverty. So it's not like, most people that you see on the streets that might be panhandling, and asking for money, you know, usually those folks actually are not homeless.
Right, right.
And moms and kids and that, you know, bulk of, you know, families and stuff, you don't see them on the streets. They're not on the streets, so.
Right. They're hidden. They're hidden homeless.
Right, which is why people have such a preconceived notion about who the homeless are, because it's not the people that you're seeing on the street.
That's a very good point. I developed and ran a homeless program through the Houston Volunteer Lawyers Program for several years, and I know more about the issue of homelessness than most people, I would say. But when I read about your mission, I stopped and asked myself, why hadn't I thought about this very basic and critical need? It had never crossed my mind, and I was embarrassed by that. When I think about how much water I drink on a daily basis at my office, at my home, at restaurants I go to, anywhere I go, water's readily available to me. But if I didn't have a home, if I didn't have an office, if I didn't go to restaurants, that would be a very different equation. The vital need became apparent to me when I read about your group, but I think it was more obvious to you for other reasons. Can you tell us your story about why you were more attuned to the homeless population than most of us would be?
Yeah. So I'm one of four children. I was raised by a single mother who grew up in an orphanage home for part of her childhood in Memphis, Tennessee. And my mother had four children that she couldn't afford very young. She started having kids at 17 years old. Wow. And I think she had a lot of post-traumatic stress disorder and probably reactive attachment disorder and issues from having been raised in an orphanage home. And really what it resulted in was lots and lots of moves. We grew up, you know, very transient. I attended 12 different schools in 12 Wow. different cities before I dropped out in the eighth grade, which is when we ended up in Hollywood. And I, you know, I've lived on Indian reservations, the Morongo Indian Reservation. We just lived everywhere, you know, in the cities that you had mentioned, and we moved every year. So while we weren't homeless, I mean, we were raised on $3,000 a year in food stamps, and we were constantly struggling. The issue for us when we were growing up was food. I mean, I was always extremely hungry. But it's the transience, I think. It was the sense of not belonging, you know, kind of the invisibility. So, you know, we were a few precarious steps above homelessness. We were never actually homeless, but the attributes and the things that go into, again, I go back to, you know, homelessness. You know, whether you're homeless or you're really dirt poor,
right?
You know, homelessness is a crisis of poverty, and it's not like you've got the homeless over in one section and then, you know, in a whole other way in another place, you've got poor people. Poor people go in and out of homelessness. You know, there's 33 million people in the United States that are kind of hanging on, actually, they're one paycheck away, according to HUD, from being homeless. So,
and 33 million people.
One paycheck away from being homeless.
Wow.
And 47 million people that are living in poverty now. So as it relates to me, and I don't want to take a bird walk from the question, you know, I think it's such a strong part of who I am. I mean, I, in many ways, will always be, you know, I think it's developed my work ethic. It's who I am. I feel very connected. I feel at home when I'm in the shelters.
But I think that so many people with that background who made the transition in life to a whole new life you did would not ever want to think about that old life again.
That was the plan. It didn't work out.
Well, what happened?
I actually never told anybody how I was raised. And had every intention, I had, you know, every dream to get out, make money, be clean and be respectable and not live on the margins of society and all
of the craziness. You even made a list, didn't you?
Yes, I did. Yeah. About, you know, what I wanted my life to be. And I just wanted it to be clean and I wanted it to be good and I wanted to be clean and I wanted to be good. And when you grow up in poverty and on the streets and stuff, you're surrounded by a lot of shady characters. Mm-hmm. And you know, you feel anything but. I think, you know, it's in some place every little girl wants to be a princess, right? I mean, right. I wanted to be something that I wasn't. And I forgot. Okay,
no,
get
no.
me back on track.
No, somebody. That's fine. When did you accept that your new life was your real life, and that you had security, you had food in the refrigerator, and you didn't have to worry about these things anymore?
Well, okay, so I ended up moving on to Paris. I was introduced to. I got a job at a pizza parlor in Century City, the Cultured Cow. My brother had gotten an assistant manager job there. And we were living in Hollywood in a $300 a month apartment.
And how old were you?
I was 14. And I dropped out of the eighth grade. I couldn't think. I couldn't function. I was very stressed out from all the places that we had lived. My brother got this job. He came home on his first day and said that he could eat whatever he wanted for free on his shift.
Wow.
And I was like, you have got to get me a job. He did. And I ended up working there. It was beneath this Schubert Theater in Century City, which was at the time Andrew Lloyd Webber had, I think, Les Miserables, or I think it was Les Miserables, premiering. And there was an agent that would come in and out of the pizza parlor. Because I worked the 3 to 11 p.m. shift with my brother, and the agent that was coming in and out kept saying, and at 14, I was like 5'10",
wow.
Thin, tall, blonde, and I look like a model. So he would say, you know, you should model. You should, you know, really think about modeling or acting or this or that. And of course, my brother was like, stay away. You know, you don't know who he is and stay away. Long story short, this guy actually happened to really be an agent, and he was the agent to several of the actors in the show. And through him and several other kind of synchronistic events, I was introduced to ultimately Eileen Ford.
Wow.
And so at 16, I moved to Paris. I did not know where Paris was. I went home to our apartment in Hollywood and told my mom, I'm going to Paris and I'm going to go make a whole bunch of money and I'm going to come back and I'm going to get us out of here.
What did she say?
Okay. Be careful. Don't get sold into white slavery. Don't go to any clubs. Don't go out. Lock your door. Don't talk to anybody. Kind of just prepped me for staying safe, but she said, okay.
You strike me as someone who's always had a good head on your shoulders, and I get that from your blog and just from the way you've conducted yourself from the earliest ages and the earliest crises in your life. Where did that come from? Did someone tell you that you were strong and capable, or did you always have that sense inside of yourself?
I think, you know, in part it came from my mother. I mean, I think that there's always been a very strong, I've always had a very strong sense of right and wrong. I mean, I don't know. I think it was probably growing up around, you know, people that were not doing the greatest of things.
That comes across so clearly in your writings that even at a very early mm-hmm. age, you were clear about what was going on around you was not appropriate most
And I didn't like it. I mean, it was very disturbing to me.
Right.
And I just somehow innately knew at a young age, like I would see things and see people. And I was just, I thought, I'm never going to do that. I'm never going to be like that. It scared me. I thought it was wrong. And so I've always just had this innate sense of right and wrong. But I think as it relates to my mother, I think was probably, you know, had hoped to be a model or an actress. And my mother was very beautiful, but she really kind of funneled that into me. I think my mother dreamed through me a lot.
Mm.
And I think it was, you know, that really filled me up with a sense about myself. I think my mother recognized that, you know, I was, as a young girl, I was, you know, very different looking than everybody else. I was exceptionally taller. I was, you know, and we were poor, so I think in some ways she probably realized that there was some way to kind of capitalize
off
of it. Yeah,
right.
Exactly.
What would you say to that kid in junior high or high school who lives a very chaotic family life and feels that they are defined by that life? Because I think that's a problem with a lot of kids who go from crisis to crisis within in their families.
You know, I think one of the things where, you know, and then working, you know, in shelters, and we were headquartered out of Houston, but we are in 4 states and 42 shelters, and we're expanding up to New York and D.C. this summer.
Congratulations.
So, thank you. Thank you. So I spend a lot of time in shelters. We have a varied shelters that we work with. And I think one of the big differentiators with our family is my mother did not drink and she did not do drugs. And I think that had something to do with it. I do see kids that are coming out of poverty, or they've been born into homelessness, and they struggle. But I think it's harder on them when they have parents that are drinking and using. And
absolutely, because that's the norm. That's how you deal with things.
Yeah. And we did not have, we weren't exposed, well, we were exposed to a lot of, you know, difficult situations and situations you really wouldn't want to have any kid in. My mother specifically kept us away from any of that type of activity, which I think
credit goes to her for that.
Absolutely. And it makes a big difference. Yeah.
It occurs to me that in both your childhood and in your modeling days, you lived an extremely nomadic existence. Was it an adjustment for you when life slowed down and stabilized and you planted roots and had a family? Was that an adjustment for you?
Yeah, it was. It was. Yeah. I mean, I modeled all the way up until the point that I had my first child at 30. And it was a huge transition. Definitely. Yeah.
Well, you said that for a long time you kept your previous life a secret. Mm-hmm. What made you decide to share your story?
Well, I ended up, you know, to kind of, I hope I'm not digressing, but I modeled for, I started when I was 16, moved to Paris, and was there for a year working in Europe based out of Paris. And then I came back to the States. I took a small break, and then I ended up going on. When I met Eileen Ford, I thought I was going straight to New York from LA. And she said, "You're never going to work in LA without a book."
Oh.
And so she said, you're going to come to New York via Paris, via Europe, which is
And how old were you?
I was 16.
Okay.
So I ended up in Paris and, well, Europe basically, but based out of Paris for a year. I went back to the States, LA, rested, took about 3 weeks off because when I arrived in Europe, my first shoot, which was the day after I got there, was with André Rau for German Cosmopolitan. But I was booked every single day for a year. I mean, I worked for L'Officiel.
It's a long way from the pizza joint.
A long way. My first job was with André. My first trip was with Marie Claire. And it was a one-month trip to Morocco, Casablanca, Essaouira, Marrakesh. And it was like,
wow.
You know, from the ghetto, you know, to Paris and America. And that was...
Did you share your backstory at that time?
Never. So I ended up after Paris in New York for 5 years, working out of New York with Eileen. And I had a friend, Lily Zanuck. Lily and Richard Zanuck are very successful. Richard has recently passed away, but Lily and Richard were very prolific, successful Hollywood producers. And I knew Lily from the business. And she called me up one night and said, I have a friend of mine, Barbara and Marvin Davis, and they're having a dinner party for the Duchess of York. And I was like, who's the Duchess of York? She's like, Fergie. And I said, okay. Well, I knew who Fergie was because I read the National Enquirer, but I didn't know who the Duchess of York was. And I ended up going to that dinner party, and I was introduced to my husband that night. And that was 24 years ago, and we've been married 21 years, but I never told anybody anything. And I told my husband about how I was raised and where I was from after we had been dating for about a year, and I realized he was probably going to ask me to get married.
How did he respond?
He was fine, and I was scared to death. I think I lost like 5 pounds in sweat telling him, because he just was from such a different background.
Right.
And but obviously it worked out. And that was it. And I never told anybody. And actually, my children didn't know until I launched I Am Waters 6 years ago.
And what made you decide to do that?
I had to write a bio and put it on the website.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, well, what am I going to say? Because I'm not saying anything to anybody. And it was like, well, why are you doing this? And I said, you know, well, we all knew why at that time, but I just didn't want to share it with the public. Nobody knew. But it's been baby steps, right. You know? I mean, it's, you know, there's so much shame that comes along with being raised, you know, with, you know, homeless, poor, dejected.
Well, I think you touch on in your writing that you felt on some level that you must have deserved it or that God didn't like you.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I've kind of felt like, absolutely.
That hit my heart when I read that.
Yeah.
It really did. Well, Elaine, I'm...
But I know God likes me now.
I was just going to ask you that.
Yes.
Uh-huh. I'm Greg Audell with Jacob Reiner, and you're listening to So What's Your Story with guest storyteller Elaine Davis, founder and president of I Am Waters. Check them out at iamwaters.com. Also, if you want to read more about Elena's incredible journey, read more about her at elenadavis.org. Elena is spelled E-L-E-N-A. You're with us on listener-sponsored 90.1 KPFT Houston, 89.5 in Galveston, and 90.3 in Livingston. We're also taking pledges tonight at 713-526-5738, or just log on to kpft.org if you like what we're doing and want to support us. We'd love to hear from you. Whether you think of yourself as a storyteller or not, you are a storyteller. In fact, it's through stories that most information has been conveyed throughout history, long before history is written down and becomes what we accept as fact. So if you appreciate a good story, visit our sponsor and the best storytelling group in the state, the Houston Storytellers Guild. Jacob, will you tell us when and where they meet?
Yes, their monthly story swaps are on the third Tuesday of the month from 7 to 8:30 p.m., located at the Multi-Service Center at 1475 West Gray. Check out all the events sponsored by the Guild and information about becoming a member at www.houstonstorytellers.org.
And Jake, could you tell us what's going on with Houston's veterans community since you are our favorite veteran? And are there any activities for Houston area veterans coming up?
At the moment, the only one I know of is next Thursday for Lone Star Veterans Association is having their monthly social and Christmas party.
Well, will you be there?
I will be there.
All right. So come on, say hi to Jake. I'm sure he'd love to meet you.
I would love to.
Next week, our host will be Dr. Warren Holloman, family psychiatrist at MD Anderson Cancer Institute. It promises to be a poignant evening. Warren is insightful, and he's captivating, and I'm proud to call him a friend. You're going to enjoy getting to know Warren and his guest, John Wayne. That's an interesting story in itself. John will be here to regale us with acid-drenched tales of life, love, and lumbama. I'm going to be listening. Tell us about your life today.
Well, today, you know, I'm a mom and I'm a wife and I run I Am Waters. I'm the founder and president of I Am Waters Foundation.
Being busy seems like a constant theme in your life.
It's been very healing. It's great. I mean, I work for the foundation. I don't take any pay. I probably work about 6 days a week. And we have, the foundation now owns I Am Brands. It's our sustainability component. So we're in Whole Foods.
Really?
Yeah, we are. In all the Southwest Whole
Foods.
When
did that happen? And how did that happen?
Yeah. When I launched I Am Waters, about a year and a half into it, I realized, the need amongst the shelters. We have 42 shelter partners now, you know, and the goal
42 shelters.
Yes. Yeah. In four states. And our goal was always to grow to be a national organization. And I thought, you know, what's our sustainability model with this? How are we going to, you know, for perpetuity and sustainability? And I went to Whole Foods and they have been amazing with us. And, you know, I said, I think your customers will buy this water. And they said, we do too. And so we created, meaning my board, I Am Brands, and it's a wholly owned subsidiary of I Am Waters Foundation. And so we sell the water at Whole Foods with 100% of the net proceeds going, you know, to the foundation and to our
100%.
100% of the net proceeds. Yeah. And we're the only product that I'm aware of on the shelves that benefit America's homeless.
You know, every stable adult has the ability to be a superhero to a kid who needs a bit of time, attention, guidance. What would you say to adults who say, well, I feel terrible for these kids in these shelters, you know, in troubled situations, but I just don't have time to deal with it?
You know, I don't really have, I don't know, because not everybody's calling is to deal with kids. I mean, first you'd have to say, I know this is what I am meant to do. First of all,
I have that sense, you know, this is what you're meant to do.
Yeah. I mean, if you know unequivocally, I was put on this earth to do this. And if it happens to be kids,
I love that.
Then you will find the way to express the gift that you have that you are to deliver to those kids, and or whatever it is, because it could be, you know, anything.
And do you have, in addition to your work with Whole Foods, do you have volunteers that work with you?
We are developing a volunteer, you know, the way that we deliver is, so we get the bottle, we have a co-packer we work with. It goes to food banks. The food banks take the water. I vet all the shelters that we deliver to. The food banks, the Feed America food banks, deliver them to our vetted shelter system. And so that's kind of the chain of distribution.
I see. Okay.
I work at, you know, go into the shelters, because we work with UCLA and now UT Health Science Center. We're doing an academic study, and I've just been in the shelters all these years just because it's my favorite place to be, as you know, kind of ground zero.
That's wonderful.
But we are now developing a volunteer program so we can get people. You know,
well, let me tell you, when that gets up and running, we would love to have you back. And I know I would love to volunteer, and I suspect many of our listeners would.
Thank you.
And if you're interested in learning more, check out iamwaters.com. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And if you want to learn more about Elena, elenadavis.org. I'd like to thank our true hometown champion, Elena Davis, for sharing your time and your story with us tonight. What do you see as your next chapters? Do you think that far ahead?
You know, it's hard to know. I think, you know, I'm a very spiritual, faithful person. And so I'm doing what I'm doing right now. And just as the woman in the intersection on one hot day in 2009 was asked me for a bottle of water, which actually kicked off I Am Waters. And we've delivered 2.9
million. Isn't that amazing? One simple act.
Yeah, 2.9 million bottles of water later. You know, this is what I'm doing now. I don't necessarily know that, you know, my next step has been delivered yet. We'll see.
Well, your eyes are open to it. Scooter is next with The Inner Side to complete the backside of the Power Hour on KPFT. Make 90.1 a part of every day. And while you're driving home, turning in for the night, or just chilling, join us every Thursday at 10 p.m. for So What's Your Story? And ease into the weekend right. Keep loving a great story, and we'll keep bringing them to you. Be good to each other. Till next week, when Dr. Warren Holloman from MD Anderson will be our host, I'm Greg Audell, reminding you of what Dr. Hank has been saying for years. From this very chair, it's never too late to live happily ever after.
This is Natalie Ortiz, your local election supervisor. It is now time to cast your vote in the local station board election. You are eligible to vote if you renewed or became a member between August 18, 2014 and August 17, 2015. Many of you were sent an email with voting instructions and password to vote online. If we did not have your email on file, you were only sent a paper ballot. Paper ballots are beginning to arrive in the mail. You can choose to vote online using the password enclosed in your paper ballot materials. If you have not yet received yours and believe you qualify to vote, please email me, kpft-les@pacifica.org. All ballots must be received or cast online by 10:59 p.m. Central Time on December 4th, 2015. Our station must receive over 600